Hi, I'm Susanna Mars, and welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. And today, I have the good fortune to talk to a very dear and old friend who's also an incredibly accomplished writer, actor, everything under the sun, and he is Mark Aceto. Thanks, Mark, for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here, but who are you calling old?
Oh, golly, that's right. Not you. Not me. Nobody.
Known.
A really, really wonderful friend who lights up my life.
Much better.
Much better.
See, yeah, well, the problem is that every time we talk live, it's a first draft.
Yes.
So naturally, we need time to revise and come up with, you know, a better pitch.
Here. I like that.
Cool.
So now, I just saw you pretty recently because I had come to New York, and I often see you when I am there. See you very up close and personal, as I usually stay with you.
Yes. And walk my dog.
Yes.
Well.
And
with Tony Kushner.
That's right.
When you come to town.
Yeah. That was.
That's what it's like to live in New York City. Is you can walk your dog with Tony Kushner in the park and occasionally see Barbara Walters or hang out with Jim Dale. It's pretty glamorous, I have to say.
It's kind of incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So how long have you lived in New York?
I left Portland in 2010, fall of 2010.
Right, because we did Holidays in 2008 and 9.
Right.
And that was at Artist Rep.
Right, and that was my first play, which I co-wrote with Cynthia Whitcomb.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote my first play by myself, Birds of a Feather, which was produced at JAW.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I got a message on Facebook from a composer named Amy Englehart, who was the sole female member of the band Without Instruments, he says, using air quotes.
The Bobs.
The Bobs.
Right.
And she was interested in collaborating with me on a piece, so she invited me to see their concert at Mississippi Studios. So I went to see their concert at Mississippi Studios, and if you've ever seen The Bobs, you know, to say a cappella doesn't really do it justice, because it's like comedy slash alternative indie rock slash jazz. I mean, it's just a really great mishmash of so many things. And I was having a fantastic time, thought they were hilarious. All the time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, what can I do with this woman? This is, we have to work on something together. We clearly are on the same wavelength. And then they got to their finale. And they did a cover, an a cappella cover of Cream's White Room. And there was this contrast in it between that sort of in a white room with black curtains. And then they get to the bridge and it went to this sort of like madrigal kind of Bach cantata, la, 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 la sort of approach. And the contrast between the rock and roll and the Baroque suddenly got me thinking about Henry Fielding's The History of Tom Jones, the 18th century novel, because that's how my brain works. I have synesthesia, which means that I tend to connect random things that aren't necessarily connected. So, I can't really describe why certain ideas lock into my brain, but this was one of them. And then, so I approached Amy about it, and we had lunch the next day. She missed her airplane back to Los Angeles, and we decided to start writing it. And we actually started writing it in Portland. She came up for 3 weeks, and we knocked out the first act in 3 weeks of the summer of 2010.
That's incredible.
And so I moved to New York, basically, with a play and a musical in my bag.
Okay, that's so interesting, because now this musical is going to be getting a production coming up this summer, so it's interesting that would be the story we started off with.
Well, yeah, it really all comes full circle, and it all really connects to Portland. And the thing about this project, though, is it's very Portland. It's in the sense that it's alternative and is a hybrid of lots of different things, in that it's. It is rock, it is classical, it is the Doris Lemming sex farce, it is a socially conscious story about otherness and diversity and inclusion. And that was in the Commercial Theater in New York, something that a lot of people had a hard time understanding. So I was able to advance my career by writing other people's shows. Basically, you know, people came to me with their projects and I rented out my brain. And that's how I got to Broadway. I mean, I moved to New York, leaving Portland, saying in 5 years, I will be on Broadway. And 5 years, practically to the day, we were at our first preview on Broadway with Allegiance. And that's a show I'd never even heard of when I moved to New York.
Tell us a little bit about, tell us a little bit about Allegiance. That's an incredible project.
Allegiance ran on Broadway last year for 100 performances. It's a musical inspired by the real life experiences of Star Trek and internet phenomenon George Takei's experiences growing up in the Japanese American internment camps during World War II. And it's a story about moral fortitude. It's a story about endurance and the immense dignity and perseverance of the Japanese American people in spite of this incredible injustice that happened upon them. And of course, in the year since it played on Broadway, it has become, you know, that much more relevant with the Syrian refugee situation and the anti-Muslim feeling and the anti-Mexican feeling in this country. I mean, a lot of people on Broadway have said to me, boy, it's just too bad you didn't open this season. But it, regardless, you know, personally, it was a real triumph and a real turning point for me and something we're immensely proud of. You know, we ran for 100 performances on Broadway and we reached 120,000 people live. And that's the same number of people who were interned during World War II.
Oh, Mark, that's remarkable.
Yeah, so it feels like each person in the audience in a way became a spokesperson for someone who is no longer able to tell that story themselves. And then we became a Fathom event, and it was shown in movie theaters nationwide, and we reached, you know, another 120,000 people. And the show has a life. There are plans for it for the future. But what it did provide was a platform for me to be able to return to a passion project, which is the one that, as I said, I began in a basement in Portland, Oregon, which, or I should say, began at Mississippi Studios, I suppose, to be accurate, which is Bastard Jones.
Well, tell us a little bit about Bastard Jones.
Well, in a way, it's sort of related to you as well, in a funny sort of way. You, of course, you know, starred in my play Holidays at Artist Repertory Theater, which is about a mom who takes in a homeless street kid. And the issues surrounding homeless youth are very dear to me. They mean a lot to me. I was a kid who moved out of his house when I turned 18, when my father accidentally married a sociopath, which, you know, formed the basis of my first novel. And then when I was 20 and I got kicked out of college, which formed the basis of my second novel, I so easily could have slipped through the cracks had it not been for theater people. In this case, my friends from high school, their parents. When I was in college, Floyd Sklaver, who eventually became my husband, we met working in the theater in New York City. So he rescued me. I rescued him. We were like two people clinging to a lifeboat because it was 1986 and it was a terrible time to be in New York. Broadway was dying. People were dying. The city was dying. It was a bad, bad time. So we escaped and we moved to Portland where, you know, metaphorically, I was always so struck by how easy it is to get things to grow.
It's so interesting because I remember when we were together last, we were talking about the idea of, you know, various regional theater. You can grow your art in a place where there's a kinder ability to grow your work. You know, when you're tender-hearted and the creative process can be very challenging.
Yeah, I wasn't tough enough for New York when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, 25 years before I developed the thick skin and the steely ambition to be able to withstand the competitive pressure in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it every day. It, again, to use a different metaphor, the thing about living in Portland is, it's a temperate climate within a, relatively narrow bandwidth of, 20 some odd degrees, give or take, most of the year.
Mm-hmm.
With the occasional, fluctuation high and low.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, you are literally living under a high pressure system all the time.
Right. On the ground and above ground.
Yes.
And underground.
And underground, exactly. And you are always competing for space.
Mm.
You walk out the door, and just to get room on the sidewalk to walk, you are competing with the people around you.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just the minute I came in, a couple weeks ago when I was there, the minute you hit the ground, the pace is just, I found myself walking faster than I ever walk here.
Right. And for me, interestingly, it suits me. I'm from here originally, as is Floyd. We're both. I'm from New Jersey. He's from Long Island. I resonate at this frequency. And when I was in Portland, as much as I was drawn to it, the speed of it, I was always trying to stir things up.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm strangely calm in New York City because the city is percolating at such a speed that I find myself being almost introverted by comparison.
That's so interesting. I totally get that.
Yeah. Huh. So it's been a fascinating journey. I got sidetracked, as I am apt to do.
Mm.
But the connection, the whole thing about homeless kids was, I was volunteering at Outside In. You might recall you came with me.
Right.
I spent, better part of a year working in their kitchen, feeding the kids and getting to know them.
Mm.
And I think my connection to them was what I was saying earlier about being a dispossessed teen and realizing that these kids I could have easily been one of these kids. I could have easily slipped through the cracks. And particularly when you consider that 40% of all homeless youth ages 16 to 24 are LGBT. I mean, that's a highly disproportionate number of LGBT kids are indeed homeless. That, just resonates even deeper with me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I hit upon Bastard Jones, I hadn't really thought about the fact that it is indeed a story about a dispossessed kid. It is a story about someone who is thrown out of his home, who is set adrift, who has to make his own way in the world. But when I realized that connective tissue and how it really, again, relates to holidays as well, and my own personal story, I realized that I wanted the show to be in service of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Allegiance that was so satisfying is that our mission as a team was to make sure that no one ever forgets this story. Now, the show lost money on Broadway. It lost, I'd say, probably everything on Broadway. And, that's a drag.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the primary mission of the show. George Takei's mission in life is to make sure that this story is told and understood and never happens again in this country or in the world. And we are right now, to date, the most highly visible storytelling of the Japanese American internment,
mm-hmm.
which is an immense honor to be able to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of took that same spirit and applied it to Bastard Jones. So 100% of the ticket sales from the show will go to Cyndi Lauper's True Colors Fund.
Right. In fact, if people are really moved by the show and the story, they can also support you by going online, correct?
Absolutely. If you Google Bastard Jones, you go to GoFundMe,
mm-hmm.
And you can find us on GoFundMe.
And I think there's also a link on the Cell Theater website.
Exactly. The Cell Theater on 23rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, if you just Google Bastard Jones, mm-hmm. it's pretty easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
We're on Facebook, YouTube, you know, but it's at, like I said, the funding site is at GoFundMe. And right now what we're looking is the funding that we need to finish up paying for the budget of the show so that all of the ticket sales and the bar sales can go to the charity. My goal here is to raise $40,000 for Cyndi Lauper's True Colors Fund in honor of the 40% of homeless youth who are LGBT. So, you know, no amount is too small. Obviously, if you're in, you know, Portland, Oregon, and this is not something that you're ever going to be able to see in its initial production, I would hope that you would still support us. We've got, you know, plenty of fun content and presence coming down the pike to be able to keep people involved and for them to know what the show is about and, you know, just be a part of the team.
Right.
To be able to, you know, change lives.
Is there a place online where people can listen to any of it at this point?
There is not, but a $50 donation will get you a free download of the show's theme song.
Oh, fantastic.
So that is... as well as a free download of Amy Engelhart's solo album, The Composer.
Who is amazing.
So a whole album, right. So a whole album and the opening song as well. So that's something.
Oh, yeah, it's something. And it's fun. The thing that I love is when you make a donation and you are a part of the family of people who are making something and you can watch it online, you can talk to the artists. It's really exciting.
Yeah, this is the very first time I've ever done crowdsourcing. I've deliberately held back from asking for help for any of my projects until I could find something that was I felt like I could really go to the mat for.
Mm.
You know, something that I felt really was worthy. And this was, yes, if in fact you go to I'm looking it up right now. If mm-hmm. you go to GoFundMe and then just type in Bastard Jones,
mm-hmm.
there is no missing it. So,
what's it like doing GoFundMe?
It's interesting. I'm right next to me on GoFundMe is the. Oops, hang on. I lost it. There we go. That was going to be a funny story. let's see if the funny story comes back. There's the guy who has raised zero of $50, who I should probably give a shout out to as well, because he's like my neighbor on GoFundMe. And his was, the reason it comes up is because I'm Bastard Jones, and his says, some bastard in cold blood willing stole a full bottle, I think he's drunk, a full bottle of Crown Royal. As most are well aware, this hits a college student hard, real hard. All donations to help in the healing process are appreciated. So his is only $50 in Golden, Colorado, so you might want to send a dollar or two that guy's way as well.
I don't know. I might stick all the money to Bastard Jones.
Well, and drinking will happen. I've actually structured the show so that there's not one but two intermissions.
Wow, that's impressive.
My feeling is that way we can... drink during the show more. And what's more, we can raise more money from the bar sales. And of course, keep in mind, I sound so serious. I sound so dead serious as I tell us. It's a door slamming sex bars.
Right.
So the drunker the audience, the funnier the show.
So tell us a little bit.
What's more, there's going to be a drinking game because every time anyone says the word bastard in the show, everyone's supposed to take a swig.
Wow, that sounds...
Well, every time you say the word bastard, if you just substitute in any other oppressed minority, it's the same story, different characters. You know, you say, you know, oh, he was born a bastard, therefore he has no rights. If you, you know, plug in Muslim, plug in, you know, trans, plug mm-hmm. in Mexican. It's, you know, the story continues over and over and over again. We're always just looking for somebody to demonize mm-hmm. and scapegoat.
Yep. So... off the subject of Bastard Jones, tell us a little bit about Chasing Rainbows, which you're also working on right now.
Chasing Rainbows is another project that found me, but had an immense amount of serendipity about it as well. It's a musical about the adolescence of Judy Garland. going from the time that she was a 13-year-old girl during the height of the Depression, whose family was dependent on her becoming a star to be able to support them, to her being cast in The Wizard of Oz. And I have long had an association, because of a near-death experience as a child, with Oz and the afterlife. It was basically after I had this near-death experience, the only language I had to describe the metaphysical experience that I had was The Wizard of Oz. And so I continually tried to communicate what had happened to me at four, almost five, using the language of The Wizard of Oz. And it was only as an adult that I finally started putting all that together. So this producer approached me about the project, not knowing that I had this, you know, immense Judy Garland fixation, this immense Oz fixation. And she started to tell me how she had a loss as a child. Her mother died when she was quite young. And she came to associate Oz with heaven, and that she felt that when Dorothy is looking at the sky during Over the Rainbow, she's singing to her dead parents. And that the entire show, the entire story is in a way sort of a metaphor for death and rebirth. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why it resonates so deeply with us. Yeah, I do think there's something beyond just being a good fantasy. The, you know, the best fantasies strike a vein, you know, existentially. And that's, so that the two of us, it was the first person I'd ever met who had had that same association with Over the Rainbow and basically analyzed the story the same way I had. So we teamed up and I started writing it. And then now we just had a production at Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, which was a very successful run. And we are now looking to bring that one to Broadway.
That's so pretty exciting.
That's going to be, you know, rather than thousands of dollars, that will be millions of dollars. So that's a bigger task. We won't be doing that on GoFundMe with the guy who got his whiskey stolen.
That's amazing.
So yeah, it's a lesson I learned during the recession. Yeah, after publishing two novels, my third novel got orphaned in 2008.
Oh, tell everyone the titles of both your novels just so they can go out and find them.
Yes. The first one is called How I Paid for College, a novel of sex, theft, friendship, and musical theater. And that won the Oregon Book Award.
And it's wonderful. It's so much fun.
Thank you. You have excellent taste.
Indeed.
And then the second one is called Attack of the Theater People, which was a sequel to it. And then there was a third called The Jazz Hands of God, which never saw the light of day. And probably rightly so. I reread it recently, and I thought, I'm kind of losing my mojo there. So it's just as well that it ended up in a drawer. But it's definitely what prompted me to move to New York, because the bottom fell out of publishing. I had, you know, exactly one book in a series that I had dedicated all of my attention to. And I realized, wow, I have to diversify. I have to work on multiple projects, because there's always the possibility that they're going to stall or just, you know, die. So, and I made sure, you know, when I moved to New York, that I was working on multiple things, and it's been busy.
Right.
And you know, not necessarily, you know, as remunerative as it might appear from the outside.
Right.
I mean, I'm lucky to be able to say that I can make a living as a playwright, and very few people get to say that. I earn less than New York City garbage man, but one could argue that what they do is really far more important than what I do. So I'm going to give that to them.
You're humble.
No, I'm not humble. I'm just aware of what would happen if there were garbage in the streets. I mean, I'm just not sure.
That's true.
If any play is more valuable than that.
How do you keep it all, you know, how can you keep all the balls in the air? I mean, I can relate that several jobs and, you know, doing a podcast and, you know, I mean, there's a lot.
Right.
How do you keep it together? Do you meditate? Do you yoga? Do you walk?
Well, certainly, as you know, I walk in Central Park every day, so I guess that is sort of my meditation. and my best thinking time in the morning, and just getting up and out and clearing my head.
You do something special because you walk your dog Lucky, and there's an incredible family of people who walk their dogs at a certain time because you don't have to have your leash on.
Yeah, neither me nor the dog.
Right. Well, especially you.
Great. Yeah.
And I mean, there's just something so lovely about it. I've done it with you many times, and it's just fantastic.
It is. It's just an immense gift to be able to experience that park and be able to, particularly in the wintertime. I like it. I like Central Park in winter the best because there are no leaves on the trees and there are no people in the park. So you really have it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And this, and as you said, this incredible community of, you know, really erudite and diverse people to communicate with and to share ideas. And we, you know, we solve all the world's problems while we're walking in the park.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably absolutely that and cycling around the city, I think, are the sort of the healthiest things that I do for coping with working on so many things. I've been really forced to focus on time management. I've just had to learn how to be able to really organize myself and be more disciplined with my time. And I by far, you know, fall short in so many ways, though I must say I'm far better than I was. So that's, I mean, really, I'm like, you know, I've got, you know, literally have my priorities laid out, you know, number one, number two, number three, number four, number five is number six, and then everything else.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that's interesting, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, I'm curious, what's something you've seen or read lately that you, you know, really inspired you?
What have I seen or read lately that really inspired me?
Even just a little.
I would have to say the first thing that came to mind was Moonlight. I thought it was so fantastic. What I loved about it was that it undermined so many expectations. You know, the drug dealer comes and you think he's going to be dangerous when in fact he turns out to be
beautiful,
benevolent. And you know, so many of the people that you think are going to be one way turn out to be another.
Just smashing stereotypes one by one.
Yes. And I thought it was also so skillfully done in that it felt absolutely rigorously real, and yet at the same time was so visually beautiful, which is a very hard thing to accomplish. You know, it had a painterly quality to it that I found so stunning to watch. I've gotten a lot of inspiration from visual art. You know, Floyd, my husband, is a docent at the Whitney Museum. He was at an ambition that began when he was at the Portland Art Museum. And so we just went to the Whitney Biennial the other day. We look at visual art a lot, and I find that to be probably the most stimulating, I think, because it gets me out of words. It gets me out of analytical and gets me into visual in my brain. That's always a really good place, I think, for an artist to be, to have pictures, you know, to solve the problem, not by sort of logic, but through intuition.
Yeah, I so agree with that. It gets the thinking process kind of turned off in some way, you know, just letting something enter your mind through pictures.
Right.
That's amazing.
And I've been hugely influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement has made a really significant impact on me, really got me to look at the lack of diversity in my life. And something called the Lily Awards in theater, which were started by Marsha Norman, the playwright, are working to get gender parity in the American theater by 2020. And that also meant a great deal to me. And I told my agent that I really wanted to reach out to working with either artists of color or women. That basically I've grown tired of, I'm the white guy in the room. You know, I'm one of the things I learned on Allegiance, very often being the only white guy in the room, was how thrilling it was to be the alone perspective and to have so much, so many other, say in this case, so many other, because it was more than one Asian culture. You know, we had a number of different people with different backgrounds playing Japanese. So it just opened up in midlife, you know, so many possibilities for me. I worked in China last year, which was, you know, mind-blowing. And I've just come to see the immense value of that. And I think, you know, honestly, I'm not sure if this is, well, I'm just going to share it because why not? We found out that we were going to get a theater for Allegiance and I was going to go to Broadway roughly around the same time that we got Gay Marriage. They were pretty close to one another in time. Hmm. And for the first time in my entire life, I felt safe. And even now, with all the, you know, rising rhetoric in the country, I feel like the genie's out of the bottle. You know, for all the hate speech that we've had, we have had a biracial president. The Supreme Court has voted for gay marriage. And while there are a lot of people trying to, you know, push back against that, the fact that that's already happened gives me an immense amount of security. And for me, at least, as somebody who always felt like an outsider and always felt unsafe in the world, for the first time in my life, I feel like I have room to be able to look out for somebody else. So the team for Bastard Jones, for instance, is one that we're assembling to look truly like America, to be, you know, gender neutral, to be racially diverse, to be, to include artists with disabilities, you know, to get as wide a spectrum of people as possible on the team, on both on stage and off stage and on, you know, behind the desk, to get as rich an experience and as representative an experience. The thing about the history of Tom Jones, the novel, is that it can be found in the personal libraries of Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and George Washington. It is, you know, a definitive text that launched the American Revolution, because it's about what they would refer to as the rights of man, you know, human rights and equality, and, you know, what I think of now is, you know, égalité. Liberté, égalité, diversité. You know, it's so American as a subject matter, despite the fact that it's a British novel. And so, you know, it was more, I'm directing the show as well.
And that's a first for you, right?
That is, not since college. Yeah, I was a directing major, actually, in college, but I haven't done it since. And I just felt like I knew what this piece was, and I've been with it for so long, I didn't want to hand it over to somebody else. I wanted to make sure that it saw the light of day with the vision that I had. And I looked at Lin-Manuel Miranda and I thought, you know, he's doing four jobs. Everyone thinks he's a genius. Now, that's only because he succeeded. If he had failed, then everyone would think it was a vanity project. So I guess those are my choices. And it's very possible I might fail. As Leonard Bernstein said, you know, don't fall off the lowest rung of the ladder. So I'm climbing to the top rung and we'll see what happens.
Oh, I wish you every success in that and every single thing you do. And I hope that everybody who listens will start putting Bastard Jones on their radar, whether they're going to be in New York and go see it in the summer at the Cell Theater or just go online and support it at GoFundMe.
Thank you. Yeah, I had someone from Portland the other day who was involved with the first reading of Birds of a Feather at PCS, Portland Center Stage, donate $25 the other day.
Oh, that's nice.
It just felt like, you know, to have that connection back to Portland. You know, I lived in Portland for 20 years.
Right. You're a big part of the community here.
Yeah. And so you know, a real piece of my heart is there, and I carry it with me.
Mm.
And, you know, there's everything I do now is still so connected to what I did there.
Mm-hmm.
So to have those moments and to have Portlanders, you know, come to New York and, you know, sleep on my couch and be a part of this endeavor and this adventure is enormously satisfying. So I hope as many Portlanders as possible will join in this process with me.
That'll be great. We'll put the podcast up and link it to the GoFundMe and off we'll go.
Thank you so much. And thanks for letting me be such a shill here for my project.
It's my pleasure. And I send you a big hug and I hope I talk to you again soon. And thank you for being a part of Adventures in Artslandia.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Juicy peaches fall from trees about to burst. Flowers beckon to the bees to quench a thirst. Passion pulses through my blood. Rapture rushes like a flood. I'm inside and I just ride. For the pursuit of happiness. It's a natural right. The pursuit of happiness. Morning, noon, and night. Oh, happiness. So warm and blazing bright. Show me a meal I'll always eat. Show me a maid who isn't sweet. Throw down a bed, I'm on my feet. For happiness. Lightning bears electric force from key to key. I'm like thunder on a horse that's wild and free. Let's surrender to the surge, celebrating every urge as we laugh and shout. What is life about? The pursuit of happiness is a natural right. The pursuit of happiness, morning, noon, and night. Cause happiness is that electric kind. I'm gonna fight more than I chew. I'm gonna drink until I spew. Plenty for me and more for you. Happiness. There's so much joy. At the root of life.